Accession number 28935, real 5.
Prescribe at real 5. How are the patrols organised? How are the patrols to escort convoys? How did you do that in the Atlantic? How is it organised? What would the ship do?
To answer that, first of all, one should bear in mind that we had been reading the German signals through Bletchley Park. That was not known to us in the ship, of course. I doubt if it was known to the captain. What we do know is that the Admiralty kept giving us information which helped us to plan our operations, and the convoy commodore even to know when he should make an alteration of course. So much of the success of the later years of the Atlantic was due to Bletchley Park. In fact, it could be argued the greatest element, the greatest contribution to the way that the Battle of the Atlantic developed was due to Bletchley Park and improved weapon systems, the arrival of Coast Command and the Fleet Air Arm. But I suppose Bletchley Park has to come at the top. So, we knew before we set out on a patrol that there might be a change of course, or for sure that there would be a change of course. That had to be taken into account. We would know that the change of course was due to information received to the effect that there were submarines in such and such an area. Our patrols were designed to keep boats at a certain distance. Now, with hindsight, I can't be more specific than that. I was, after all, just a junior officer required to fly his machine and get it back safely. We would do these patrols perhaps at the most twice a day in the Atlantic. They would begin before dawn and end after dusk. Now, the dusk patrol was an interesting animal. The U-boats would like to get astern of the convoy, not too far away, and hope to catch up on the surface overnight. So we would put out a patrol aft. And that might be as much as 50 miles away. We are dealing with an aircraft which cruises at about 82 knots, and it is near the end of its patrol, getting short of fuel. It is way back aft because it's there to put down any boat hoping to catch up on the surface. And while there, the wind changes. It turns against you when you're due to head back for the carrier. Not only does it turn against you, it strengthens. So here you see a problem. Is there enough fuel left to battle one's way back to the carrier? And I may say that the first sight one would have in any case at night of one's carrier, or in knowledge that one had found the convoy, would be the sight of phosphorescence in the water beneath, made by the ship's wakes. All ships, of course, were thoroughly blacked out. So that was an interesting state of affairs.
Where would you pick the convoys up from?
We would normally pick them up off Northern Ireland. Having left the Clyde, left Londonderry on one's port hand, starting to round, I think it's Rathlin, is it? Yes. Anyway, in that area one would pick up the convoy. Now, you will be, of course, catching up a convoy, which would say it was from Liverpool. These are Liverpool convoys taking the passage between the Mull of Kintyre and Northern Ireland. They would have been properly assembled by the time they'd debauched from that channel. And we would then pick them up and take them to somewhere in the neighbourhood of Newfoundland, where the Canadians would take over and the main threat, submarine threat, was passed. We would pick up a convoy coming out of North America and take it back perhaps to the point where we'd collected the last one off Northern Ireland. So there is the second convoy dealt with, and then one would pick up a third. That one might not be going to North America, it could be going to the Mediterranean or West Africa. So we take that down, we wouldn't see Gibraltar, pick up another one coming out of the Mediterranean or from West Africa, bring it up, and then with luck, having done these four convoys, we could then sight land again after a month or more and have, hopefully, a spot of leave.
You mentioned how exposed you were in the cockpit on patrols. What type of flying gear were you wearing at the time?
Well, anything we cared to wear, I would say, that was warm. In the Arctic, though, we had a proper immersion suit. It was a two-piece effort with boots attached to the legs. The collar was tight-fitting rubber. Round the wrists, tight-fitting rubber. A genuine two-piece effort. Beneath that, one wore a string vest and a good cotton shirt and ordinary uniform trousers, as I recall. And it was sufficient for exposure there, but I'm told that in the water it might have been good for about 5 minutes. The interesting thing, I think, for all of us was the protection that one's flying helmet gave one. This was a leather helmet. One wore this helmet plus goggles. And the main difficulty with flying at 3,000 feet in the open cockpit was the effect of cold wind on the gap between your goggles and your helmet. It's so fierce that it stunned one. It made one peculiar. That is why I think that I was caught napping one day at a fairly low height, minding my own business, not watching as closely as I should have done, on my way back to the ship, when I was caught by a spray, if one can call it that, of unpleasant anti-aircraft missiles. Very smelly stuff, too.
Can you just describe that a little bit more for me, what has actually happened? You're heading back to the ship and...
Heading back to the ship. I think that this submarine captain had noticed this aircraft ambling its way back. Something made him think that it was worth surfacing and having a go. After all, this is pure guesswork, but this is what happened. It was a very unwise thing to do on his part. I'm not saying I thank him afterwards. I tried, but he's probably one of those caught later on bars, because we were catching several. He shouldn't, in my view, have surfaced. He should have just let one go by.
What did you do? Did you attack the sort
of... This should interest you. My reaction to this was utter indignation. How dare anybody fire guns at me? It says something about me, but I believe that others have reacted the same way as well the first time they've been shot at. How dare they? I then immediately obeyed Admiralty instructions, which was to get out of the way, because it had been found in earlier months that a swordfish, with its slow closing speed, travelling upwind against a target which is firing at you, has very little chance of getting there. You're a sitting duck. So if you were carrying depth charges, That was the doctrine we were required to follow, not to try and close the boat, because it meant you had to go all the way right over his conning tower. If you were carrying rockets, that was a different story. And if you want to come to that some stage, I can talk about rockets, I know a bit about them. But there it is, the swordfish was a sitting duck with depth charges. And yet in our squadron we had one man who disobeyed both times. He sank two boats with his depth charges, and all he got for his pains was this unexploded 20mm shell lodged in a lower main plane. He's the only man in the Navy, in the Fleet Air Arm, on his own to have sunk two U-boats, and he's in the same squadron we're talking about.
Can you give me a picture of what the squadron's activities were and how successful they were during that period?
Our activities were at sea entirely aimed at keeping the submarine at bay, or to put it in another way, to ensure that our merchant ships reached port. That was the job. Now, on the North Atlantic, we only personally saw one U-boat, although, of course, many must have seen us. One U-boat surfaced between ourselves and a fellow aircraft carrier. Many of us saw it. I was on the flight deck, and we had an aircraft on standby. This boat surfaced. A head appeared in the conning tower wearing a white cap and immediately disappeared again, and the boat submerged. Meanwhile, there was a shouting on our flight deck. The standby swordfish was manned. It was off the flight deck in probably 3 minutes. It did a climbing turn, went astern of the convoy to start looking, and no sooner had it arrived than a boat started to emerge. And it was attacked with depth charges and sunk. The evidence showed that it was sunk, and the Admiralty said it was sunk. The Germans say it was not sunk, that they don't know what happened to it. The boat's number was U666. We do know that that boat had been damaged about a day earlier by Coast Command and had reported back to base that it had been damaged but was going to continue. My guess is that this boat had been so damaged that it could not stay submerged for any length of time. It had to come up. It was forced to. Why else, having come up in the middle of a convoy, then repeat the exercise within minutes unless you were in desperate straits aboard that boat? Well, it paid the price. That is the only boat that we actively saw on the Atlantic. When it came to the Arctic, it was a different matter, because we were then operating within a pinch point, that is to say, between Bear Island, north of North Cape, and North Cape itself. Around North Cape, there are German airfields, there are surface units, major units, and this was a pinch point through which we had to pass, because beyond the northern end, side of the pinch point, was the ice barrier. So we were between the ice barrier and North Cape. And this was going on week after week with convoys. The Germans knew where to find us, and we knew we would be found. And also, interestingly, that is where the German U-boats, rather than submerge and stay submerged, would come up again very quickly. And we found ourselves, and other squadrons, I think, found the same thing, found that no sooner had we seen a boat, started towards it, and seen it submerge, and then we would turn away, that there'd be a report of a boat surfacing again, apparently in the same area. We were constantly sighting boats, and we carried out, I believe, at least 11 direct attacks on boats, of which we sank three on that occasion. Two of them by depth charge, and myself by rockets. Now, the rocket is, as I said, I think to you, this is an interesting weapon. The U-boats feared the rocket because it was perfectly capable of piercing the hull and going right through. My crew, we had just taken off when my observer, looking into his magic box of tricks behind his ASV, said there's something we want to look at over to port, and so we headed that direction and saw something. It was white water in the distance that didn't break. Sure sign, boat on surface. My observer says, right, we're going to climb into cloud and I'm going to give you the courses. So I did exactly what he told me. Gave me course to steer, started to give me a description of what he was seeing. Eventually he said, turn 90 degrees to port and go into a dive and you'll find a boat. So I did, and we were carrying rockets. So I had already switched on, really. Came out of the cloud, there was not one boat, but two. The second boat, the commander was looking in my direction because he was talking across to the other boat, presumably saying, where is the convoy, or something like it. He managed to submerge pretty quickly. I carried out what I understand to be the proper form of attack, which was, we were roughly at 20 degree, 30 degree dive, and I launched rockets in pairs to enter the water short of the boat and ahead. On entering the water, the rocket levels out, so it has a good strike angle on the hull. And this must have worked. And in fact, I felt so confident at the time that when I came to the fourth salvo, I changed direction for where I thought the first boat was. So in effect, I had, in 2 days, attacked three boats in two attacks. And that is my claim to fame.
Was the U-boat sunk?
For a long time, it wasn't known, but it seems that the first boat that I have described got signal off to base saying that such and such, actually it was U674, I think, was sunk, had been sunk at this particular time and by this particular man. That was the only evidence. And I didn't know about this until after the squadron was disbanded. I didn't know that it was for sure. But that's the way of it. You do not know what damage you have inflicted to something below the water any more than a boat that is diving and that has fired at an attacking aircraft knows, in fact, if it has shot that aircraft down.
You mentioned the prescribed attack with rockets, that you
yes.
would come at a certain angle and you would fire it.
That is, yes.
How do you actually fire the rockets? Well, how do you
in salvo.
And how do you do that within the...
Press a button.
Is it set to fire in pairs, or can you...
Set to fire in pairs. Yes, I could have gone one, you know, pressed four times and just... Now, I know what you're asking, could have fired all eight at once. I don't recall that was the case. It was certainly not an advisable thing to do, because what you're doing is you're altering... You can see where the rockets are going, and you can make an adjustment if you think you're making a boob. I mean, take the fact that I felt that I felt so confident of having hit the boat that I could put my last pair to another purpose.
Is there a tangible effect on the aircraft when you fire them?
None whatsoever that I noticed. None at all.
You mentioned that that was a stage where you'd attacked three boats in 2 days.
Yes.
What was the one the day before?
Well, actually, I suppose it was four boats, because I had a run across another one as well, all within about 48 hours. But this fellow also I went for with rockets, but he was a bit of an angle facing towards me a bit, and I think the rockets glanced off. But yes, actually, they were four boats in three attacks, which is unusual.
You mentioned earlier in the interview about there was a method of attack that would involve a fighter and a rocket.
Yes.
Could you explain that?
Now, yes, I would. I'd be delighted to. The Americans were experts at this, and anybody who studies the warfare on the North Atlantic against the U-boat should be very well aware of what the Americans achieved with their escort carriers, the same class of ship that I've been describing that I served in. They used the Avenger, the Grumman Avenger, and the Wildcat. Now, between those two aircraft, you've got less of a disparity in speed than you find between the Swordfish and a Seafire or a Wildcat. The idea of the coordinated attack is to keep the guns crews on the U-boat, their heads down, clear the deck. This was successfully used, incidentally, in the very first attack carried out on U-boat, which was successful with the rocket. That was from the carrier Archer, escort carrier Archer. And there, fighters were used to clear the deck. In our case, the thing is, first of all, to get the fighter in to make its attack at the same time as the Swordfish is already on its way down. It's going to arrive, and it must arrive after the fighter. The closer the two events occur, the better. But it is extremely difficult. It takes a lot of training, and we didn't have the time for this training, and we hardly trained it. But it is extremely difficult to synchronize such an attack. And we were very unsuccessful, by and large. But the Americans were extremely successful. They were sinking boats regularly by this system of Avenger and Wildcat together.
You also mentioned, obviously, operating in the Arctic. Are there any special conditions that occur while operating in the Arctic that differ from, say, the Atlantic combat?
Oh, yes, certainly. Consider that you return, you're frozen stiff. You need help to get out of that aircraft. Well, personally, my own view of the chaps that look after aircraft, they were always helping us out, so you could hardly tell the difference wherever we were. You relied on these people. But yes, one was very, very tired. In our case, we brought a convoy of 40 plus ships out from Murmansk, were detected just south of Bear Island. And 12 boats, as it turned out later to have been, gathered around us. We had shadowers. Those boats stayed with us for 3.5 days. And we flew for 3.5 days round the clock in conditions, half-light conditions. We had with us a British-built escort carrier, metal flight deck. There was snowstorms and so forth, squalls, correction, not storms, so squalls, and I would say 4 to 6 inches of snow on the flight deck, which the British carrier couldn't cope with. They couldn't get it off the deck, so they couldn't operate aircraft safely. So they left it to us. They said, sorry, deck's out of action, please take over. So we did. We had our, whatever they were, nine Swordfish crew, flying round the clock for 3.5 days, keeping 3 aircraft in the air. Well, it doesn't take much in mathematics to realize that there's a lot of action then taking place. And it is that sort of thing that really wears one down.
What position would the carrier take up in a convoy?
The carrier's normal position was in a box in the middle. And I described it as a box because your convoy is made up of columns of ships. So, and the convoy itself should be broad rather than deep, because that gives a narrower angle for the U-boat to aim at. If you have a deep convoy, the torpedo spread is more likely to pick up stuff. So you want a broad convoy, broad front. The middle convoy, the middle columns of the convoy would have two or three ships per column, and then whereas the other columns might go down to seven or eight in the column, there would be a gap. So you might have as many as four columns that have been denuded of the cargo vessels, leaving the carrier in the box. Now within that box, ideally, your captain will be able to maneuver his ship in such a way that he can not only launch but recover, bearing in mind that to do that he must always head almost into wind. You can allow for up to 10 degrees off the bow, and it must be blowing from the starboard across so that you're not blown into the island. So that is the area, ideally, in which you will be doing your flying. But in practice, the wind may be astern, and you've got to do a 180 and launch out of the protection of the convoy. And the most you'll have with you is one escort vessel to accompany you to pick up somebody who's gone over the side. And I may say that crashing on a flight deck was normal, of the normal thing. You expected it. There were crashes all the time. Hopefully not over the side. But if there is somebody over the side, there's a vessel to pick him up, you hope. Today, there's a chopper around to pick up and so forth. But then, out of the convoy, speed is of the essence. Get the fellas off, get the blokes returning from patrol on, and get back inside the convoy as quick as possible. And you will be astonished, I can tell you, at the speed and efficiency which a well-worked-up squadron can show. Your intervals between deck landing of aircraft should be 15 to 20 seconds. 15 to 20 seconds. Let us go back to the beginning. We are launching a patrol. There's your lead aircraft on the flight deck. The signal goes to launch him. It's a green flag. Down goes the green flag. Off he goes. Then there's another one behind him. He's sent off. He almost captures the wash of the one in front of him as he's off. The moment he's off, up comes the crash barrier. What's happening aft? The batsman has already got his bats out, signalling to the first of the aircraft coming back from patrol. So no sooner has that second aircraft departed for patrol than the first of the returning patrol is actually coming across on its final approach. Behind it, by now or about above the beam, is the other one coming in. On he comes. The aircraft is disengaged from the hook is disengaged from the arrestor wire. It is brought back across the barrier. Up comes the barrier. And just as that barrier comes up, the final moments of the next aircraft are there. And that is how it works. And it has got to work fast. And it is very interesting when working with other carriers to notice how we would compete with one another in speed. For example, the attack on the Tirpitz, we were on two of these. And we would watch these squadrons, how they operated, the speed and efficiency with which they would go off. In the case of the Tirpitz, forming up at sea level to keep below the radar. We were out of sight of land, but radar was there. And then to see them coming back and bang, bang, bang. It's a competition, and we were proud of it.